True Grit by Charles Portis, narrated by Donna Tartt, with an essay by Donna Tartt at the end of this program. 25 years have passed, and Matty Ross, in a voice strong and true, here tells how, in the winter of 1870-something, as a 14-year-old girl from Dardanelle, Arkansas, she rode out into Indian Territory to revenge the murder of her father. And now? True Grit.
People do not give it credence that a 14-year-old girl could leave home and go off in the wintertime to avenge her father's blood. But it did not seem so strange then, although I will say it did not happen every day. I was just 14 years of age when a coward, going by the name of Tom Cheney, shot my father down in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and robbed him of his life and his horse and $150 in cash money, plus 2 California gold pieces that he carried in his trouser band. Here is what happened. We had clear title to 480 acres of good bottom land on the south bank of the Arkansas River, not far from Dardanelle in Yell County, Arkansas. Tom Cheney was a tenant, but working for hire and not on shares. He turned up one day hungry and riding a gray horse that had a filthy blanket on his back and a rope halter instead of a bridle. Papa took pity on the fella and gave him a job and a place to live. It was a cotton house made over into a little cabin. It had a good roof. Tom Cheney said he was from Louisiana. He was a short man with cruel features. I will tell more about his face later. He carried a Henry rifle. He was a bachelor, about 25 years of age. In November, when the last of the cotton was sold, Papa took it in his head to go to Fort Smith and buy some ponies. He had heard that a stock trader there named Colonel Stonehill had bought a large parcel of cow ponies from Texas drovers on their way to Kansas and was now stuck with them. He was getting shed of them at bargain rates, as he did not want to feed them over the winter. People in Arkansas did not think much of Texas Mustang ponies. They were little and mean. They had never had anything but grass to eat and did not weigh over 800 pounds. Papa had an idea they would make good deer hunting ponies, being hardy and small and able to keep up with the dogs through the brush. He thought he would buy a small string of them, and if things worked out, he would breed and sell them for that purpose. His head was full of schemes. Anyway, it would be a cheap enough investment to start with, and we had a patch of winter oats and plenty of hay to see the ponies through till spring, when they could graze in our big north pasture and feed on greener and juicier clover than they ever saw in the Lone Star State. As I recollect, shelled corn was something under 15 cents a bushel then. Papa intended for Tom Cheney to stay and look after things on the place while he was gone. But Cheney set up a fuss to go, and after a time he got the best of Papa's good nature. If Papa had a failing, it was his kindly disposition. People would use him. I did not get my mean streak from him. Frank Ross was the gentlest, most honorable man who ever lived. He had a common school education. He was a Cumberland Presbyterian and a Mason, and he fought with determination at the Battle of Elkhorn Tavern, but was not wounded in that scrap, as Lucille Biggers Langford states in her Yell County Yesterdays. I think I am in a position to know the facts. He was hurt in the terrible fight at Chickamauga, up in the state of Tennessee, and came near to dying on the way home from want of proper care. Before Papa left for Fort Smith, he arranged for a colored man named Yarnell Poindexter to feed the stock and look in on Mama and us every day. Yarnell and his family lived just below us on some land he rented from the bank. He was born of free parents in Illinois, but a man named Bloodworth kidnapped him in Missouri and brought him down to Arkansas just before the war. Yarnell was a good man, thrifty and industrious, and he later became a prosperous house painter in Memphis, Tennessee. We exchanged letters every Christmas until he passed away in the flu epidemic of 1918. To this day, I have never met anybody else named Yarnell, white or black. I attended the funeral and visited in Memphis with my brother, little Frank, and his family. Instead of going to Fort Smith by steamboat or train, Papa decided he would go on horseback and walk the ponies back all tied together. Not only would it be cheaper, but it would be a pleasant outing for him and a good ride. Nobody loved to gad about on a prancing steed more than Papa. I have never been very fond of horses myself, although I believe I was accounted a good enough rider in my youth. I never was afraid of animals. I remember once I rode a mean goat through a plum thicket on a dare. From our place to Fort Smith was about 70 miles as a bird flies, taking you past beautiful Mount Nebo, where we had a little summer house so Mama could get away from the mosquitoes, and also Mount Magazine, the highest point in Arkansas. But it might as well have been 700 miles for all I knew of Fort Smith. The boats went up there, and some people sold their cotton up there, but that was all I knew about it. We sold our cotton down in Little Rock. I had been there two or three times. Papa left us on his saddle horse, a big chestnut mare with a blazed face called Judy. He took some food and a change of clothes rolled up in some blankets and covered with a slicker. This was tied behind his saddle. He wore his belt gun, which was a big, long dragoon pistol, the cap and ball kind that was old-fashioned even at that time. He had carried it in the war. He was a handsome sight, and in my memory's eye, I can still see him, mounted up there on Judy in his brown woolen coat and black Sunday hat, and the both of them, man and beast, blowing little clouds of steam on that frosty morn. He might have been a gallant knight of old. Tom Chaney rode his gray horse that was better suited to pulling a middle buster than carrying a rider. He had no handgun, but he carried his rifle slung across his back on a piece of cotton plow line. There is trash for you. He could have taken an old piece of harness and made a nice leather strap for it. That would have been too much trouble. Papa had right around $250 in his purse, as I had reason to know since I kept his books for him. Mama was never any good at sums, and she could hardly spell cat. I do not boast of my own gifts in that direction. Figures and letters are not everything. Like Martha, I have always been agitated and troubled by the cares of the day, but my mother had a serene and loving heart. She was like Mary, and had chosen that good part. The two gold pieces that Papa carried concealed in his clothes were a marriage gift from my grandfather Sperling in Monterey, California. Little did Papa realize that morning that he was never to see us or hold us again, nor would he ever again hearken to the meadowlarks of Yale County trilling a joyous anthem to spring. The news came like a thunderclap. Here is what happened. Papa and Tom Chaney arrived in Fort Smith and took a room at the Monarch boarding house. They called on Stonehill at his stock barn and looked over the ponies. It fell out there was not a mare in the lot, or a stallion for that matter. The Texas cowboys rode nothing but geldings for some cowboy reason of their own, and you can imagine they are no good for breeding purposes. But Papa was not to be turned back. He was determined to own some of those little brutes, and on the second day he bought four of them for $100 even, bringing Stonehill down from his asking price of $140. It was a good enough buy. They made plans to leave the next morning. That night, Tom Chaney went to a bar room and got into a game of cards with some riffraff like himself and lost his wages. He did not take the loss like a man, but went back to the room at the boarding house and sulled up like a possum. He had a bottle of whiskey, and he drank that. Papa was sitting in the parlor talking to some drummers. By and by, Chaney came out of the bedroom with his rifle. He said he had been cheated and was going back to the barroom and get his money. Papa said that if he had been cheated, then they'd best go talk to the law about it. Chaney would not listen. Papa followed him outside and told him to surrender the rifle as he was in no fit state to start a quarrel with a gun in his hand. My father was not armed at that time. Tom Chaney raised his rifle and shot him in the forehead, killing him instantly. There was no more provocation than that, and I tell it as it was told to me by the High Sheriff of Sebastian County. Some people might say, "Well, what business was it of Frank Ross to meddle?" My answer is this. He was trying to do that short devil a good turn. Chaney was a tenant, and Papa felt responsibility. He was his brother's keeper. Does that answer your question? Now, the drummers did not rush out to grab Chaney or shoot him, but instead scattered like poultry, while Chaney took my father's purse from his warm body and ripped open the trouser band and took the gold pieces, too. I cannot say how he knew about them. When he finished his thieving, he raced to the end of the street and struck the night watchman at the stock barn a fierce blow to the mouth with his rifle stock. knocking him silly. He put a bridle on Papa's horse Judy and rode out bareback. Darkness swallowed him up. He might have taken the time to saddle the horse, or hitched up 3 spans of mules to a Concord stagecoach and smoked a pipe, as it seems no one in that city was after him. He had mistaken the drummers for men. The wicked flee when none pursueth. Lawyer Daggett had gone to Helena to try one of his steamboat suits, and so Yarnell and I rode the train to Fort Smith to see about Papa's body. I took around $100 expense money and wrote myself out a letter of identification and signed Lawyer Daggett's name to it and had Mama sign it as well. She was in bed. There were no seats to be had on the coaches. The reason for this was that there was to be a triple hanging at the federal courthouse in Fort Smith, and people from as far away as East Texas and North Louisiana were going up to see it. It was like an excursion trip. We rode in a colored coach, and Yarnell got us a trunk to sit on. When the conductor came through, he said, "Get that trunk out of the aisle, nigger." I replied to him in this way, "We will move the trunk, but there is no reason for you to be so hateful about it." He did not say anything to that, but went on taking tickets. He saw that I had brought to all the darkies' attention how little he was. We stood up all the way, but I was young and did not mind. On the way, we had a good lunch of spare ribs that Yarnell had brought along in a sack. I noticed that the houses in Fort Smith were numbered, but it was no city at all compared to Little Rock. I thought then, and still think, that Fort Smith ought to be in Oklahoma instead of Arkansas, though of course it was not Oklahoma across the river then, but the Indian Territory. They have that big, wide street there called Garrison Avenue, like places out in the West. The buildings are made of fieldstone, and all the windows need washing. I know many fine people live in Fort Smith, and they have one of the nation's most modern waterworks, but it does not look like it belongs in Arkansas to me. There was a jailer at the sheriff's office, and he said that we would have to talk to the city police or the high sheriff about the particulars of Papa's death. The sheriff had gone to the hanging. The undertaker was not open. He had left a notice on his door saying he would be back after the hanging. We went to the Monarch boarding house, but there was no one there except a poor old woman with cataracts on her eyes. She said that everybody had gone to the hanging but her. She would not let us in to see about Papa's traps. At the city police station, we found 2 officers, but they were having a fistfight and were not available for inquiries. Yarnell wanted to see the hanging, but he did not want me to go, so he said we should go back to the sheriff's office and wait there till everybody got back. I did not much care to see it, but I saw he wanted to. So I said no, we would go to the hanging, but I would not tell Mama about it. That was what he was worried about. The federal courthouse was up by the river on a little rise, and the big gallows was hard beside it. About 1,000 or more people and 50 or 60 dogs had gathered there to see the show. I believe a year or two later they put up a wall around the place, and you had to have a pass from the marshal's office to get in, but at this time it was open to the public. A noisy boy was going through the crowd, selling parched peanuts and fudge. Another one was selling hot tamales out of a bucket. This is a cornmeal tube filled with spicy meat that they eat in old Mexico. They are not bad. I had never seen one before. When we got there, the preliminaries were just about over. 2 white men and an Indian were standing up there on the platform with their hands tied behind them and the 3 nooses hanging loose beside their heads. They were all wearing new jeans and flannel shirts buttoned at the neck. The hangman was a thin, bearded man named George Malden. He was wearing 2 long pistols. He was a Yankee, and they say he would not hang a man who had been in the G.A.R. A marshal read the sentences, but his voice was low, and we could not make out what he was saying. We pushed up closer. A man with a Bible talked to each of the men for a minute. I took him for a preacher. He led them in singing, "Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound," and some people in the crowd joined in. Then Malden put the nooses on their necks and tightened up the knots just the way he wanted them. He went to each man with a black hood and asked him if he had any last words before he put it on him. The first one was a white man, and he looked put out by it all, but not upset, as you might expect from a man in his desperate situation. He said, "Well, I killed the wrong man, and that is why I am here. If I had killed the man I meant to, I don't believe I would have been convicted. I see men out there in that crowd that is worse than me." The Indian was next, and he said, "I am ready. I have repented my sins, and soon I will be in heaven with Christ my Savior. Now I must die like a man." If you are like me, you probably think of Indians as heathens. But I will ask you to recall the thief on the cross. He was never baptized and never even heard of a catechism, and yet Christ himself promised him a place in heaven. The last one had a little speech ready. You could tell he had learned it by heart. He had long yellow hair. He was older than the other two, being around 30 years of age. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, my last thoughts are of my wife and my two dear little boys who are far away out on the Cimarron River. I don't know what is to become of them. I hope and pray that people will not slight them and compel them to go into low company on account of the disgrace I have brought them. You see what I have come to because of drink. I killed my best friend in a trifling quarrel over a pocket knife. I was drunk, and it could just as easily have been my brother. If I had received good instruction as a child, I would be with my family today and at peace with my neighbors. I hope and pray that all you parents in the sound of my voice will train up your children in the way they should go. Thank you. Goodbye, everyone." He was in tears, and I am not ashamed to own that I was, too. The man mouthed and covered his head with the hood and went to his lever. Yarnell put a hand over my face, but I pushed it aside. I would see it all. With no more ado, Malden sprung the trap, and the hinged doors fell open in the middle, and the three killers dropped to judgment with a bang. A noise went up from the crowd as though they had been struck a blow. The two white men gave no more signs of life. They spun slowly around on the tight, creaking ropes. The Indian jerked his legs and arms up and down in spasms. That was the bad part, and many in the crowd turned in revulsion and left in some haste, and we were among them. We were told that the Indian's neck had not been broken, as was the case with the other two, and that he swung there and strangled for more than a half hour before a doctor pronounced him dead and had him lowered. They say the Indian had lost weight in jail and was too light for a proper job. I have since learned that Judge Isaac Parker watched all his hangings from an upper window in the courthouse. I suppose he did this from a sense of duty. There is no knowing what is in a man's heart. Perhaps you can imagine how painful it was for us to go directly from that appalling scene to the undertaker's where my father lay dead. Nevertheless, it had to be done. I have never been one to flinch or crawfish when faced with an unpleasant task. The undertaker was an Irishman. He took Yarnell and me to a room at the back that was very dark owing to the windows being painted green. The Irishman was courteous and sympathetic, but I did not much like the coffin he had placed Papa in. It was resting on three low stools and was made of pine planks that had not been cleanly dressed. Yarnell took off his hat. The Irishman said, "And is that the man?" He held a candle in his face. The body was wrapped in a white shroud. I said, "That is my father." I stood there looking at him. What a waste. Tom Cheney would pay for this. I would not rest easy until that Louisiana cur was roasting and screaming in hell. The Irishman said, "If you would like to kiss him, it will be all right." I said, "No, put the lid on it." We went to the man's office, and I signed some coroner's papers. The charge for the coffin and the embalming was something over $60. The shipping charge to Dardanelle was $9.50. Yarnell took me outside the office. He said, "Miss Mattie, that man trying to stick you." I said, "Well, we will not haggle with him." He said, "That is what he counted on." I said, "We will let it go." I paid the Irishman his money and got a receipt. I told Yarnell to stay with the coffin and see that it was loaded on the train with care and not handled roughly by some thoughtless railroad hand. I went to the sheriff's office.
The High Sheriff was friendly, and he gave me the full particulars on the shooting, but I was disappointed to learn how little had been done toward the apprehension of Tom Chaney. They had not even got his name right. The Sheriff said, "We do know this much. He was a short man, but well set up. He had a black mark on his cheek. His name is Chambers. He is now over in the territory, and we think he was in the party with Lucky Ned Pepper that robbed a mail hack Tuesday down on the Poteau River." I said, "That is the description of Tom Chaney. There is no Chambers to it. He got that black mark in Louisiana when a man shot a pistol in his face and the powder got under the skin. Anyhow, that is his story. I know him and can identify him. Why are you not out looking for him?" The Sheriff said, "I have no authority in the Indian Nation. He's now the business of the U.S. Marshals." I said, "When will they arrest him?" He said, "It's hard to say. They'll have to catch him first." I said, "Do you know if they are even after him?" He said, "Yes, I have asked for a fugitive warrant, and I expect there's a federal John Doe warrant on him now for the mail robbery. I will inform the marshals as to the correct name."
"I will inform them myself," said I. "Who is the best marshal they have?" The Sheriff thought on it for a minute. He said,
"I would have to weigh that proposition. There's near about 200 of them. I reckon William Waters is the best tracker. He's a half-breed Comanche, and it's something to see, watching him cut for sign. The meanest one is Rooster Cogburn. He's a pitiless man, double tough, and fear don't enter into his thinking. He loves to pull a cork. Now, L.T. Quinn, he brings his prisoners in alive. He may let one get by now and then, but he believes even the worst of men is entitled to a fair shake. Also, the court does not pay any fees for dead men. Quinn is a good peace officer and a lay preacher to boot. He won't plant evidence or abuse a prisoner. He is as straight as a string. Yes, I will say Quinn is about the best they have." I said, "Where can I find this Rooster?" He said, "You'll probably find him in federal court tomorrow. They will be trying that Wharton boy."
The Sheriff had Papa's gun belt there in a drawer, and he gave it to me in a sugar sack to carry. The clothes and blankets were at the boarding house. The man Stonehill had the ponies and Papa's saddle at his stock barn. The Sheriff wrote me out a note for the man Stonehill and the landlady at the boarding house, who was a Mrs. Floyd. I thanked him for his help. He said he wished he could do more. It was around 5:30 p.m. when I got to the depot. The days were growing short, and it was already dark. The southbound train was to leave some few minutes after 6 o'clock. I found Yarnell waiting outside the freight car where he had loaded the coffin. He said the express agent had consented to let him ride in the car with the coffin. He said he would go help me find a seat in a coach, but I said, "No, I will stay over a day or two. I must see about those ponies, and I want to make sure the law is on the job. Chaney has got clean away, and they're not doing much about it." Yarnell said, "You can't stay in this city by yourself." I said, "It'll be all right. Mama knows I can take care of myself. Tell her I'll be stopping at the Monarch boarding house. If there's no room there, I'll leave word with the Sheriff where I am." He said, "I reckon I stay too." I said, "No, I want you to go with Papa. When you get home, tell Mr. Myers I said to put him in a better coffin." "Your mama will not like this," said he. "I'll be back in a day or two. Tell her I said not to sign anything until I get home. Have you had anything to eat?"
"I had me a cup of hot coffee. I ain't hungry."
"Do they have a stove in that car?"
"I'd be all right wrapped in my coat."
"I sure do appreciate this, Yarnell.
Mr. Frank was always mighty good to me."
Some people will take it wrong and criticize me for not going to my father's funeral. My answer is this: I had my father's business to attend to.
He was buried in his mason's apron by the Danville Lodge. I got to the Monarch in time to eat. Mrs. Floyd said she had no vacant room because of the big crowd in town, but that she would put me up somehow. The daily rate was 75 cents a night with two meals, and a dollar with three meals. She did not have a rate for one meal, so I was obliged to give her 75 cents, even though I had planned to buy some cheese and crackers the next morning for my daytime eats. I don't know what her weekly rate was. There were 10 or 12 people at the supper table, and all men, except for me and Mrs. Floyd, and the poor old blind woman, who was called Grandma Turner. Mrs. Floyd was a right big talker. She explained to everybody that I was the daughter of the man who had been shot in front of her house. I did not appreciate it. She told about the event in detail and asked me impertinent questions about my family. It was all I could do to reply politely. I didn't wish to discuss the thing with idly curious strangers, no matter how well-intentioned they might be. I sat at one corner of the table between her and a tall, long-backed man with a doorknob head and a mouthful of prominent teeth. He and Mrs. Floyd did most of the talking. He traveled about selling pocket calculators. He was the only man there wearing a suit of clothes and a necktie. He told some interesting stories about his experiences, but the others paid little attention to him, being occupied with their food like hogs rooting in a bucket. "Watch out for those chicken and dumplings," he told me. Some of the men stopped eating. "They'll hurt your eyes," he said. A dirty man across the table in a smelly deerskin coat said, "How is that?" With a mischievous twinkle, the drummer replied, "They will hurt your eyes looking for the chicken." I thought it a clever joke, but the dirty man said angrily, "You squirrel-headed son of a bitch," and went back to eating. The drummer kept quiet after that. The dumplings were all right, but I could not see 25 cents and a little flour and grease. After supper, some of the men left to go to town, probably to drink whiskey in the bar rooms and listen to the hurdy-gurdy. The rest of us went to the parlor. The boarders dozed and read newspapers and talked about the hanging, and the drummer told yellow fever jokes. Mrs. Floyd brought out Papa's things that were bundled in the slicker, and I went through them and made an inventory. Everything seemed to be there, even his knife and watch. The watch was of brass and not very expensive, but I was surprised to find it because people who will not steal big things will often steal little things like that. I stayed in the parlor and listened to the talk for a while, and then asked Mrs. Floyd if she would show me to my bed. She said, "Go straight down that hall to the last bedroom on the left. There's a bucket of water and a washpan on the back porch. The toilet is out back directly behind the chinaberry tree. You'll be sleeping with Grandma Turner." She must have seen the dismay on my face, for she added, "It'll be all right. Grandma Turner will not mind. She's used to doubling up. She will not even know you are there, sweet." Since I was the paying customer, I believed my wishes should have been considered before Grandma Turner's, though it seemed neither of us was to have any say. Mrs. Floyd went on, saying, "Grandma Turner is a sound sleeper. It is certainly a blessing at her age. Don't worry about waking Grandma Turner, a little mite like you." I did not mind sleeping with Grandma Turner, but I thought Mrs. Floyd had taken advantage of me. Still, I saw nothing to be gained from making a fuss at that hour. She already had my money, and I was tired, and it was too late to look for lodging elsewhere. The bedroom was cold and dark and smelled like medicine. A wintry blast came up through the cracks in the floor. Grandma Turner turned out to be more active in her slumber than I had been led to expect. When I got into bed, I found she had all the quilts on her side. I pulled them over, I said my prayers, and was soon asleep. I awoke to find that Grandma Turner had done the trick again. I was bunched up in a knot and trembling with cold from the exposure. I pulled the covers over again. This happened once more later in the night, and I got up, my feet freezing, and arranged Papa's blankets and slicker over me as makeshift covers. Then I slept all right. Mrs. Floyd served me no meat for breakfast, only grits and a fried egg. After eating, I put the watch and knife in my pocket and took the gun along in the sugar sack. At the federal courthouse, I learned that the head marshal had gone to Detroit, Michigan, to deliver prisoners to the House of Correction, as they called it. A deputy who worked in the office said they would get around to Tom Chaney in good time, but that he would have to wait his turn. He showed me a list of indicted outlaws that were then on the loose in the Indian Territory, and it looked like the delinquent tax list that they run in the Arkansas Gazette every year in little type. I did not like the looks of that, nor did I care much for the smarty manner of the deputy. He was puffed up by his office. You can expect that out of federal people, and to make it worse, this was a Republican gang that cared nothing for the opinion of the good people of Arkansas who are Democrats. In the courtroom itself, they were impaneling a jury. The bailiff at the door told me that the man, Rooster Cogburn, would be around later in the day when the trial began, as he was the main witness for the prosecution. I went to Stonehill Stock Barn. He had a nice barn, and behind it a big corral and a good many small feeder pens. The bargain cow ponies, around 30 head, all colors, were in the corral. I thought they would be broken-down scrubs, but they were frisky things, with clear eyes, and their coats looked healthy enough, though dusty and matted. They'd probably never known a brush. They had burrs in their tails. I had hated these ponies for the part they played in my father's death, but now I realized the notion was fanciful, that it was wrong to charge blame to these pretty beasts who knew neither good nor evil, but only innocence. I say that of these ponies. I've known some horses, and a good many more pigs, who I believe harbored evil intent in their hearts. I will go further and say all cats are wicked, though often useful. Who has not seen Satan in their sly faces? Some preachers will say, well, that is superstitious claptrap. My answer is this. Preacher, go to your Bible and read Luke chapter 8, verses 26 through 33. Stonehill had an office in one corner of the barn. On the door glass it said, Colonel G. Stonehill, licensed auctioneer, cotton factor. He was in there behind his desk, and he had a red-hot stove going. He was a prissy, bald-headed man with eyeglasses. I said, how much are you paying for cotton? He looked up at me and said, 9.5 for low-middling and 10 for ordinary. I said, we got most of ours out early and sold it to Woodson Brothers in Little Rock for 11 cents. He said, then I suggest you take the balance of it to the Woodson Brothers. We've sold it all, said I. We only got 10.5 on the last sale. Why did you come here to tell me this? I thought we might shop around up here next year, but I guess we're doing all right in Little Rock. I showed him the note from the sheriff. After he had read it, he was not disposed to be so short with me. He took off his eyeglasses and said, it was a tragic thing. May I say, your father impressed me with his manly qualities. He was a close trader, but he acted the gentleman. My watchman had his teeth knocked out and can take only soup. I said, I'm sorry to hear it. He said, the killer has flown to the territory and is now on the scout there. This is what I heard. He will find plenty of his own stamp there, said he. Birds of a feather. It is a sink of crime. Not a day goes by, but there comes some new report of a farmer bludgeoned, a wife outraged, or a blameless traveler set upon and cut down in a sanguinary ambuscade. The civilizing arts of commerce do not flourish there. I said, I have hopes that the marshals will get him soon. His name is Tom Chaney. He worked for us.
I am trying to get action. I aim to see him shot or hanged.
Yes, yes, well might you labor to that end, said Stonehill. At the same time, I will counsel patience. The brave marshals do their best, but they are few in number. The lawbreakers are legion, and they range over a vast country that offers many natural hiding places. The marshal travels about friendless and alone in that criminal nation. Every man's hand is against him there, save in large part for that of the Indian, who has been cruelly imposed upon by felonious intruders from the States.
I said, I would like to sell those ponies back to you that my father bought.
He said, I fear that is out of the question. I will see that they are shipped to you at my earliest convenience.
I said, we don't want the ponies now. We don't need them.
That hardly concerns me, he said. Your father bought these ponies and paid for them, and there is an end of it. I have the bill of sale. If I had any earthly use for them, I might consider an offer, but I've already lost money on them, and be assured I do not intend to lose more. I will be happy to accommodate you in shipping them. The popular steamer Alice Waddell leaves tomorrow for Little Rock. I will do what I can to find space on it for you and the stock.
I said, I want $300 for Papa's saddle horse that was stolen.
He said, you will have to take that up with the man who has the horse.
Tom Cheney stole it while it was in your care, said I. You are responsible.
Stonehill laughed at that. He said, I admire your sand, but I believe you will find I am not liable for such claims. Let me say, too, that your valuation of the horse is high by about $200.
I said, if anything, my price is low. Judy is a fine racing mare. She's won purses of $25 at the fair. I have seen her jump an 8-rail fence with a heavy rider.
All very interesting, I am sure, said he.
Then you will offer nothing?
Nothing except what is yours. The ponies are yours. Take them. Your father's horse was stolen by a murderous criminal. This is regrettable, but I had provided reasonable protection for the animal as per the implicit agreement with the client. We must each of us bear our own misfortunes. Mine is that I have temporarily lost the services of my watchman.
I will take it to law, said I.
You must do as you think best, said he.
We will see if a widow and her 3 small children can get fair treatment in the courts of this city.
You have no case. Lawyer J. Noble Daggett of Dardanelle, Arkansas, may think otherwise. Also a jury.
Where is your mother?
She's at home, in Yell County, looking after my sister Victoria and my brother, little Frank.
You must fetch her, then. I do not like to deal with children.
You'll not like it any better when Lawyer Daggett gets hold of you. He is a grown man.
You are impudent.
I do not wish to be, sir, but I will not be pushed about when I am in the right.
I will take it up with my attorney.
And I will take it up with mine. I will send him a message by telegraph, and he will be here on the evening train. He will make money, and I will make money, and your lawyer will make money, and you, Mr. Licensed Auctioneer, will foot the bill.
I cannot make an agreement with a child. You are not accountable. You cannot be bound to a contract.
Lawyer Daggett will back up any decision I make. You may rest easy on that score. You can confirm any agreement by telegraph.
This is a damned nuisance, he exclaimed. How am I to get my work done? I have a sale tomorrow.
There can be no settlement after I leave this office, said I. It will go to law. He worried with his eyeglasses for a minute, and then said,
I will pay $200 to your father's estate when I have in my hand a letter from your lawyer absolving me of all liability from the beginning of the world to date. It must be signed by your lawyer and your mother, and it must be notarized. The offer is more than liberal, and I only make it to avoid the possibility of troublesome litigation. I should never have come here. They told me this town was to be the Pittsburgh of the Southwest.
I said, I will take $200 for Judy, plus $100 for the ponies, and $25 for the gray horse that Tom Cheney left.
He is easily worth $40. That is $325 total.
The ponies have no part in this, said he.
I will not buy them.
Then I will keep the ponies, and the price for Judy will be $325.
Stonehill snorted.
I would not pay $325 for winged Pegasus, and that splay-footed gray does not even belong to you.
I said, yes, he does. Papa only let Tom Cheney have the use of him.
My patience is wearing thin. You are an unnatural child. I will pay $225 and keep the gray horse. I don't want the ponies. I cannot settle for that.
This is my last offer.
$250. For that, I get a release, and I keep your father's saddle. I am also writing off a feed and stabling charge. The gray horse is not yours to sell.
The saddle is not for sale. I will keep it.
Lawyer Daggett can prove the ownership of the gray horse. He will come after you with a writ of replevin.
All right. Now, listen very carefully, as I will not bargain further. I will take the ponies back and keep the gray horse and settle for $300. Now, you must take that or leave it, and I do not much care which it is.
I said, I'm sure Lawyer Daggett would not wish me to consider anything under $325. What you get for that is everything except the saddle, and you get out of a costly lawsuit as well. It will go harder if Lawyer Daggett makes the terms, as he will include a generous fee for himself.
Lawyer Daggett! Lawyer Daggett! Who is this famous pleader of whose name I was happily ignorant 10 minutes ago?
I said, have you ever heard of the Great Arkansas River, Vicksburg, and Gulf Steamship Company?
I have done business with the GAV&G, said he.
Lawyer Daggett is the man who forced them into receivership, said I. They tried to mess with him. It was a feather in his cap. He is on familiar terms with important men in Little Rock. The talk is he will be governor one day.
Then he is a man of little ambition, said Stonehill, incommensurate with his capacity for making mischief. I would rather be a country road overseer in Tennessee than governor of this benighted state. There is more honor in it.
If you don't like it here, you should pack your traps and go back where you came from.
Would that I could get out from under, said he. I would be aboard the Friday morning packet with a song of thanksgiving on my lips.
People who don't like Arkansas can go to the devil, said I. What did you come here for?
I was sold a bill of goods.
$325 is my figure.
I would like to have that in writing for what it is worth.
He wrote out a short agreement. I read it over and made a change or two, and he initialed the changes. He said,
tell your lawyer to send the money to me here, at Stonehill's livery stable. When I have it in my hand, I will remit the extortion money. Sign this.
I said, I will have him send the letter to me at the Monarch boarding house. When you give me the money, I will give you the letter. I'll sign this instrument when you have given me $25 as a token of your good faith. Stonehill gave me $10, and I signed the paper. I went to the telegraph office. I tried to keep the message down, but it took up almost a full blank, setting forth the situation and what was needed. I told Lawyer Daggett to let Mama know I was well and would be home soon. I forget what it cost. I bought some crackers and a piece of hoop cheese and an apple at a grocery store and sat on a nail keg by the stove and had a cheap yet nourishing lunch. You know what they say, enough is as good as a feast. When I had finished eating, I returned to Stonehill's place and tried to give the apple core to one of the ponies. They all shied away and would have nothing to do with me or my gift. The poor things had probably never tasted an apple. I went inside the stock barn out of the wind and lay down on some oat sacks. Nature tells us to rest after meals, and people who are too busy to heed that inner voice are often dead at the age of 50 years. Stonehill came by on his way out, wearing a little foolish Tennessee hat.
He stopped and looked at me. I said, "I am taking a short nap." He said, "Are you quite comfortable?" I said, "I wanted to get out of the wind. I figured you would not mind."
"I don't want you smoking cigarettes in here."
"I don't use tobacco." "I don't want you punching holes in those sacks with your boots." "I will be careful. Shut that door good when you go out." I had not realized how tired I was. It was well up in the afternoon when I awoke. I was stiff and my nose had begun to drip. Sure sign of a cold coming on. You should always be covered while sleeping. I dusted myself off and washed my face under a pump and picked up my gun sack and made haste to the federal courthouse. When I got there, I saw that another crowd had gathered, although not as big as the one the day before. My thought was, what? Surely they are not having another hanging. They were not. What had attracted the people this time was the arrival of two prisoner wagons from the territory. The marshals were unloading their prisoners and poking them sharply along with their Winchester repeating rifles. The men were all chained together like fish on a string. They were mostly white men, but there were also some Indians and half-breeds and Negroes. It was awful to see, but you must remember that these chained beasts were murderers and robbers and train wreckers and bigamists and counterfeiters, some of the most wicked men in the world. They had ridden the Hoot Owl Trail and tasted the fruits of evil, and now justice had caught up with them to demand payment. You must pay for everything in this world one way and another. There is nothing free except the grace of God. You cannot earn that or deserve it. The prisoners who were already in the jail, which was in the basement of the courthouse, commenced to shout and catcall through little barred windows at the new prisoners, saying, "Fresh fish," and such like. Some of them used ugly expressions so that the women in the crowd turned their heads. I put my fingers in my ears and walked through the people up to the steps of the courthouse and inside. The bailiff at the door did not want to let me in the courtroom as I was a child, but I told him I had business with Marshal Cogburn and held my ground. He saw I had spunk, and he folded right up, not wanting me to cause a stir. He made me stand beside him just inside the door, but that was all right because there were no empty seats anyway. People were even sitting on windowsills. You will think it strange, but I had scarcely heard of Judge Isaac Parker at that time, famous man that he was. I knew pretty well what was going on in my part of the world, and I must have heard mention of him in his court, but it made little impression on me. Of course, we lived in his district, but we had our own circuit courts to deal with killers and thieves. About the only outlaws in our country who ever went to federal court were moonshiners, like old man Jerry Vick and his boys. Most of Judge Parker's customers came from the Indian Territory, which was a refuge for desperados from all over the map. Now, I will tell you an interesting thing. For a long time, there was no appeal from his court, except to the President of the United States. They later changed that, and when the Supreme Court started reversing him, Judge Parker was annoyed. He said those people up in Washington City did not understand the bloody conditions in the territory. He called Solicitor General Whitney, who was supposed to be on the judge's side, a pardon broker, and said he knew no more of criminal law than he did of the hieroglyphics of the Great Pyramid. Well, for their part, those people up there said the judge was too hard and high-handed and too long-winded in his jury charges, and they called his court the Parker Slaughterhouse. I don't know who was right. I know 65 of his marshals got killed. They had some mighty tough folks to deal with. The judge was a tall, big man with blue eyes and a brown billy goat beard, and he seemed to me to be old, though he was only around 40 years of age at that time. His manner was grave. On his deathbed, he asked for a priest and became a Catholic. That was his wife's religion. It was his own business and none of mine. If you had sentenced 160 men to death and seen around 80 of them swing, then, maybe at the last minute, you would feel the need of some stronger medicine than the Methodist could make. It is something to think about. Toward the last, he said he didn't hang all those men, that the law had done it. When he died of dropsy in 1896, all the prisoners down there in that dark jail had a jubilee, and the jailers had to put it down. I have a newspaper record of a part of that Wharton trial, and it is not an official transcript, but it is faithful enough.
I have used it and my memories to write a good historical article that I titled, "You will now listen to the sentence of the law, Otis Wharton, which is that you be hanged by the neck until you are dead, dead, dead. May God, whose laws you have broken and before whose dread tribunal you must appear, have mercy on your soul." Being a personal recollection of Isaac C. Parker, the famous border judge. But the magazines of today do not know a good story when they see one. They would rather print trash. They say my article is too long and discursive. Nothing is too long or too short either if you have a true and interesting tale and what I call a graphic writing style combined with educational aims. I do not fool around with newspapers. They are always after me for historical write-ups, but when the talk gets around to money, the paper editors are most of them cheapskates. They think because I have a little money, I will be happy to fill up their Sunday columns just to see my name in print, like Lucille Biggers Langford and Florence Mabry Whiteside. As the little colored boy says, not none of me. Lucille and Florence can do as they please. The paper editors are great ones for reaping where they have not sown. Another game they have is to send reporters out to talk to you and get your stories free. I know the young reporters are not paid well, and I would not mind helping those boys out with their scoops if they could ever get anything straight. When I got in the courtroom, there was a Creek Indian boy on the witness stand, and he was speaking in his own tongue, and another Indian was interpreting for him. It was slow going. I stood there through almost an hour of it before they called Rooster Cogburn to the stand. I had guessed wrong as to which one he was, picking out a younger and slighter man with a badge on his shirt, and I was surprised when an old one-eyed Jasper that was built along the lines of Grover Cleveland went up and was sworn. I say old. He was about 40 years of age. The floorboard squeaked under his weight. He was wearing a dusty black suit of clothes, and when he sat down I saw that his badge was on his vest. It was a little silver circle with a star in it. He had a mustache like Cleveland, too. Some people will say, well, there were more men in the country at that time who looked like Cleveland than did not. Still, that is how he looked. Cleveland was once a sheriff himself. He brought a good deal of misery to the land in the panic of 93, but I am not ashamed to own that my family supported him and has stayed with the Democrats right on through, up to and including Governor Alfred Smith, and not only because of Joe Robinson. Papa used to say that the only friends we had down here right after the war were the Irish Democrats in New York. Thad Stevens and the Republican gang would have starved us all out if they could. It is all in the history books. Now, I will introduce Rooster by way of the transcript and get my story back on the rails.
Mr. Barlow, state your name and occupation, please.
Mr. Cogburn.
Reuben J. Cogburn. I am a deputy marshal for the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Arkansas, having criminal jurisdiction over the Indian Territory.
Mr. Barlow, how long have you occupied such office?
Mr. Cogburn,
be 4 years in March.
On November 2nd, were you carrying out your official duties?
I was, yes, sir.
Did something occur on that day out of the ordinary?
Yes, sir.
Please describe in your own words what that occurrence was.
Yes, sir. Well, not long after dinner on that day, we was headed back for Fort Smith from the Creek Nation and was about 4 miles west of Weber's Falls.
One moment. Who was with you?
There was 4 other deputy marshals and me. We had a wagon load of prisoners and was headed back for Fort Smith. 7 prisoners. About 4 miles west of Weber's Falls, that Creek boy named Will come riding up in a lather. He had news. He said that morning he was taking some eggs over to Tom Spotted Gourd and his wife at their place on the Canadian River. When he got there, he found the woman out in the yard with the back of her head shot off and the old man inside on the floor with a shotgun wound in his breast.
An objection, Judge Parker.
Confine your testimony to what you saw, Mr. Cogburn.
Yes, sir. Well, Deputy Marshal Potter and me rode on down to Spotted Gourd's place with the wagon to come on behind us. Deputy Marshal Smith stayed with the wagon. When we got to the place, we found everything as the boy Will had represented.
The woman was out in the yard dead with blowflies on her head, and the old man was inside with his breast blowed open by a scattergun and his feet burned. He was still alive, but he just was. Wind was whistling in and out of the bloody hole. He said about 4 o'clock that morning, them two Wharton boys had rode up there drunk.
An objection. This is a dying declaration, Your Honor.
Overruled. Proceed, Mr. Cogburn. He said them two Wharton boys, Otis and C.C. by name, had rode up there drunk and throwed down on him with a double-barrel shotgun and said, "Tell us where your money is, old man." He would not tell them, and they lit some pine knots and held them to his feet, and he told them it was in a fruit jar under a gray rock at one corner of the smokehouse. Said he had over $400 in banknotes in it. Said his wife was crying and taking on all this time and begging for mercy. Said she took off out the door, and Otis run to the door and shot her. Said when he raised up off the floor where he was laying, Otis turned and shot him. Then they left.
What happened next?
He died on us. Passed away in considerable pain.
Mr. Spotted Gourd, that is.
Yes, sir.
What did you and Marshal Potter do then?
We went out to the smokehouse, and that rack had been moved, and that jar was gone.
An objection. The witness will keep his speculations to himself. You found a flat gray rock at the corner of the smokehouse with a hollowed-out space under it.
If the prosecutor is going to give evidence, I suggest that he be sworn.
Mr. Barlow, that is not proper examination.
I am sorry, Your Honor.
Marshal Cogburn, what did you find, if anything, at the corner of the smokehouse?
We found a gray rock with a hole right by it.
What was in the hole?
Nothing. No jar or nothing.
What did you do next?
We waited on the wagon to come. When it got there, we had a talk amongst ourselves as to who would ride after the Whartons. Potter and me had had dealings with them boys before, so we went. It was about a 2-hour ride up near where the North Fork strikes the Canadian, on a branch that turns into the Canadian. We got there not long before sundown.
And what did you find?
I had my glass, and we spotted the two boys and their old daddy, Aaron Wharton by name, standing down there on the creek bank with some hogs, 5 or 6 hogs. They had killed a shoat and was butchering it. It was swinging from a limb, and they had built a fire under a washpot for scalding water. We tied up our horses about 1/4 mile down the creek and slipped along on foot through the brush so we could get the drop on them. When we showed, I told the old man, Aaron Wharton, that we was U.S. Marshals and we needed to talk to his boys. He picked up an axe and commenced to cussing us and blackguarding this court.
What did you do?
I started backing away from the axe and tried to talk some sense to him. While this was going on, C.C. Wharton edged over by the wash pot behind that steam and picked up a shotgun that was laying up against a saw log. Potter seen him, but he was too late. Before he could get off a shot, C.C. Wharton pulled down on him with one barrel and then turned to do the same for me with the other barrel. I shot him, and when the old man swung the axe, I shot him. Otis lit out for the creek, and I shot him. Aaron Wharton and C.C. Wharton was dead when they hit the ground. Otis Wharton was just winged.
Then what happened?
Well, it was all over. I dragged Otis Wharton over to a blackjack tree and cuffed his arms and legs around it with him setting down. I tended to Potter's wound with my handkerchief as best I could. He was in a bad way. I went up to the shack, and Aaron Wharton's squaw was there, but she would not talk. I searched the premises and found a quart jar under some stove wood that had banknotes in it to the tune of $420.
What happened to Marshal Potter?
He died in this city 6 days later of septic fever. Leaves a wife and 6 babies.
An objection. Strike the comment. What became of Otis Wharton?
There he sits.
You may ask, Mr. Gowdy.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow. How long did you say you have been a deputy marshal, Mr. Cogburn?
Gone on 4 years.
How many men have you shot in that time? An objection.
There is more to this shooting than meets the eye, Your Honor. I am trying to establish the bias of the witness.
Objection overruled. How many, Mr. Cogburn?
I never shot nobody I didn't have to.
That was not the question. How many?
Shot or killed?